Thank you very much, Dr. Fenton and Dr. Bolin and Penny and others who invited me to cross the Great Divide and join you at the STD conference. I think as people here know, HIV is an STD, and many of us who have worked in both areas realize that there are shared goals. We're long-term companions in prevention, and consequently, the title given to me for my talk by others was STD and HIV Natural Bedfellows. And as you can see from this photo, Dr. Bolin and I are BFFs, though I should state openly, we're not hitting the sack. Okay. So today I'm going to discuss some major HIV events in the past 2 years, an overview of the HIV epidemic, some priority prevention interventions and strategies, and then touch on high-impact prevention framework with some programmatic examples. So it's an exciting time in HIV prevention. In 2009, the White House issued the National HIV/AIDS Strategy. The U.S. restriction on entry of persons with HIV was removed, allowing for the 2012 International AIDS Society Conference to be in Washington, D.C. this summer. But it is also a difficult time for many of us with broad community, local, state, and federal budget and staffing reductions, and ultimately a loss of over 45,000 public health positions in the United States. ADAP waiting lists continue, and the ban on federal funding of syringe services was recently reinstated. But while this has been a challenging time from a human and financial resource perspective, it's also provided us with tremendous research results. Studies recently showed that a tenofovir-containing vaginal microbicide used by women reduced acquisition of HIV by 39% and HSV2 by 51%. Antiretroviral therapy reduced transmission of HIV by 96% and acquisition of HIV through pre-exposure prophylaxis or PrEP by between 44 and 73%. Male circumcision reduced human papillomavirus, HSV2, and short and long-term HIV acquisition among heterosexual men, and reduced HPV in female partners of circumcised men, and it may decrease HIV acquisition in primarily insertive MSM. Fourth-generation HIV tests are available that detect 80% of acute HIV infection, otherwise only diagnosed by nucleic acid testing. And the response to HPV vaccine recommendations in the U.S. kind of suggests potential opportunities and operational issues for an HIV vaccine if and when developed. So these portend a hopeful future for prevention in an epidemic that needs hope, because the HIV epidemic in the U.S. is growing. Today, 1.2 million people are living with HIV in the country, and each year there are about 50,000 new HIV infections and 16,000 deaths among people with AIDS, which means we have a net increase of over 30,000 people living with HIV each year. From one perspective, this is good news, since it reflects improved care, and people who start ART now are expected to live at least an additional 35 years. However, it also represents a challenge, as the number of people with HIV in the country has increased 60% in the past 15 years. So this is illustrated here. The number of people living with HIV, shown in red, has risen every year because survival has increased, and the annual number of new HIV infections, shown in blue and green on the bottom, is greater than the number of deaths. This is a reflection of treatment and also a partial success of prevention, as incidence has remained stable even as the number of people with the potential to transmit HIV has grown. However, these data are also a clarion call for rapid effort. The first line in white represents the current situation in the U.S., where stable incidence, as we currently have, in 10 years would result in 550,000 new HIV infections. The orange line shows that if we reach the goal of reducing incidence by 25% over 10 years, we would prevent 62,000 infections and save the healthcare system $23 billion. If we meet the 25% goal over 5 years, as recommended by the National HIV Strategy and shown in green, then we would save 109,000 infections and $42 billion. Faster action now saves lives and resources later. And the context is not simple. This pie chart shows the 2011 presidential budget request for federal funding for HIV. It's an impressive budget, $27 billion, and it's comprehensive, including research and care, housing, and global activities. However, please note that domestic HIV prevention in light lavender is only 3%, and half of Americans feel that the federal government spends too little on HIV in the United States. In addition, as Dr. Fenton touched on, HIV highlights health inequity, a situation similar to many STDs. MSM are more than 40 times more likely than other men to have HIV, and an estimated 19% of all MSM and 29% of African-American MSM have HIV. African-Americans are 8 times more likely, and Latinos are 3 times more likely to have HIV than white Americans. Additionally, about 1 in 32 African-American women, 1 in 100 Latinas, 1 in 180 Native Americans and Pacific Islanders, 1 in 220 American Indian Alaska Natives, and 1 in 500 white or Asian women will be diagnosed with HIV in her lifetime. HIV prevalence is associated with population density, region of residence, poverty, education, and employment. And HIV, gonorrhea, and syphilis are quintessential issues of disparity. That is why many of us work in the field, and it's why we will never achieve true prevention success without striving for health equity. And these social determinants and epidemiologic issues are paramount. For example, racial and ethnic differences in HIV prevalence disappeared in a study of heterosexuals who all lived in high-prevalence, poor, urban areas of the U.S. So lastly, this figure shows trends in the estimated number of new HIV infections in the country by transmission category. Whereas there was a substantial decrease in new infections among MSM, heterosexuals, and IDUs in the late 1980s and 90s, that decrease seems to have continued for all groups except MSM. Since the mid-1990s, there's been a 74% increase in the number of new infections among MSM, and most recently a 48% increase in HIV incidence among young African-American MSM between 2006 and 2009. So the U.S. has experienced a growing HIV epidemic concentrated in specific areas with marked disparities and an increasing incidence among MSM. And these data call for us to better align resources and better monitor and respond to the epidemic. So there's an urgent need to implement effective programs, and I've highlighted here some specific HIV prevention interventions categorized by those focused on prevention with positives to reduce transmission, those focused on negatives to reduce acquisition, and a few not focused on HIV status. And I'll discuss only a few of these. First, with prevention with positives, really focuses on efforts to help people with HIV not transmit the virus. It includes a wide array of services. PWP often represents an efficient use of resources because the number needed to reach, less than 1% of the nation, is low compared to the population of people without HIV. HIV testing and diagnosis is prevention. It's estimated that 20% of people with undiagnosed HIV in the country, about 230,000, are associated with more than 50% of sexual transmission. And the 80% who are diagnosed, because they know they have HIV and are more likely to access prevention and treatment services, and less likely to transmit HIV to their partners. Routine opt-out screening in clinical settings costs between $2,000 and $6,000 per person with HIV diagnosed. Partner testing and linkage services help people with HIV access care and reduce transmission through early identification of undiagnosed infection. And in one study, 20% of partners tested through provider notification had undiagnosed HIV. Partner services are cost-effective. In one study, the median cost per new diagnosis was $7,800. And in a session I just saw, Chichu Udeagu showed similar rates among partners of homeless people in New York City and a truly remarkable linkage to care rate of over 90%. It is impossible to access HIV-specific care without laboratory diagnosis of infection, and it is increasingly difficult to conceive of HIV prevention activities that do not incorporate knowledge of status. For example, it's estimated that 68% of HIV transmission among MSM is from main partners due to higher number of sex acts with main partners, more frequent receptive role in sex with main partners, and lower condom use. For HIV discordant partnerships, partnering couples testing is critical to prevent transmission. And STD and HIV programs at CDC issued joint partner services recommendations in 2008. People with HIV benefit from risk reduction interventions. Between 32 and 54% of men and 42% of women with HIV receiving medical care in the U.S. reported unprotected anal or vaginal sex. Interventions focused on sexual behavior change among people with HIV reduce unprotected sex by 43% and acquisition of STDs by 80%. And in this slide, it just shows that risk reduction interventions should include antiretroviral therapy. You can see on the graph that the proportion of patients in an outpatient cohort taking ART increased over several years, as shown in blue, while the number of deaths decreased, as shown in green. In addition, ART is not only effective care, but as mentioned earlier, reduces transmission. So people with HIV can only access ART and take their drugs regularly if they're linked to the healthcare system. Only 69% of people with HIV attend a clinic within 12 months of their diagnosis, but there are cost-effective services that improve linkage. For example, case management improves linkage by 32% at a cost of about $1,200 per person, and interventions focused on adherence increase the likelihood of having an undetectable viral load by 15%. However, effectiveness depends on coverage during the entire cascade from testing to care, and transmission reductions can vary from 15 to 44% depending on the drop-off along the continuum of care. So this can be best illustrated in this figure. Of 1.2 million people with HIV, 80% are diagnosed. Of those persons who are aware of their infection, approximately 77% get linked to HIV medical care within 3 months of diagnosis. Of those diagnosed, 51% remain in care. Of those in care, most receive ART, and of those, approximately 77% have a suppressed viral load, ultimately leaving 850,000 people, or 72% of the people with HIV in the country, without a viral load below 200 cells per milliliter, which is considered optimal for care and prevention. So ultimately, to succeed, we'll need to see prevention as healthcare and healthcare as prevention. How do we make HIV and STD prevention services a normative part of healthcare? This includes making HIV and STD testing as routine as cholesterol testing and risk reduction interventions for people with and at high risk for HIV and STDs as common as nutrition counseling or foot care for people with diabetes. How do we ensure reimbursement systems support routine HIV and STD prevention services within clinics and by community-based organizations? Doing this will not only allow us to improve individual care, but could also benefit community-wide prevention. For example, in San Francisco, between 2004 and 2008, the estimated incidence of HIV decreased from 935 infections to 621 annually, as shown in the red triangles. And as we see, concomitant declines in HIV diagnoses and mean community viral load. This is a remarkable feat. In the U.S., we have an increasing epidemic among MSM, but the San Francisco HIV prevention leadership, who as of yesterday is the director of the White House Office of National AIDS Policy, and the Safer Sex enthusiastic population of San Francisco, as seen on the right, have shown a consistent decline in HIV incidence in an epidemic predominantly affecting MSM. Now I'll discuss some options for prevention of negatives. The mainstay of prevention for people with HIV is condom distribution and a safer sex education. Use of condoms is associated with an 80% reduction in acquisition of HIV, and these programs are effective across a variety of populations. A recent meta-analysis of 21 studies of distribution programs showed a doubling of condom use, a 30% reduction in STDs, and delayed age of sexual debut. Condom distribution was also found to be cost-saving in a study among at-risk women. But I'd like to pause here and recognize that while condoms are an essential component of HIV and STD prevention, we also have to update our behavior change messages, which often seem to recommend universal condom use. On one hand, I'm not sure condoms are enough in some situations, such as HIV discordant couples. And on the other, I'm not sure whether we can really expect that almost every person in the country, regardless of length of relationship, marriage, age, or HIV status, will use condoms every time she or he has sex. I looked on the web for more information to express my thoughts about this question and found this commentary. Oh, there's no volume. Uh-oh. What do we do for that? Escape. You guys are missing out something really good. I'm going to have to keep going.
The check is coming. The help is arriving. What did you think of doing first?
Doing it plain until it gets back there. It's not working on page down. It's page down isn't working.
Touch the slot.
Okay. So I've lost a few slides in doing this, but here's our commentator. Give
him the evil look.
So she was wondering too. And I wanted to say the data do support that people change their condom use based on their perceived risk situation. So ultimately, we'll need to give better guidance on how they can best do that. So in a national sample, more than 70% of adolescents reported condom use during last sex. However, only 22% of women and 25% of men of all ages reported condom use. And use was more than twice as likely with casual than relationship partners. Couples stopped using condoms over time. Men and women were more than 5 times less likely to use condoms if they had sex more than 10 times previously, highlighting the importance of HIV testing and knowledge of status if we were to expect continued condom use in long-term relationships. And people in HIV-discordant couples are more likely to use condoms and probably to adhere to ART when used for PrEP. So knowledge of self and partner HIV and STD status is critical for prevention. The goal of many of our behavioral interventions for people without HIV is to reduce risk behavior and increase condom use. And over 70 such interventions were effective in randomized trials. Several reduced STDs in real-world practice, for example, in programs implemented by community-based organizations and STD clinics. And many of the interventions meet criteria for Category B in the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force, which would support reimbursement with no copay by most insurance plans in 2014. But it also raises questions. For example, who is trained to provide the interventions, and how much and how frequently per individual will the healthcare system reimburse for them? Most behavioral interventions need to be updated to include antiretroviral therapy, PrEP, and other innovative approaches to prevention, something I think of as a Debbie makeover. And there's also a need to ensure linkage of patients requiring more intensive services to allied health or community providers. So in this slide, I just highlight some of the new information related to pre-exposure prophylaxis. Daily tenofovir emtricitabine, a drug normally used for ART, treatment of people with HIV, reduced acquisition of HIV among MSM and transgender individuals, as well as heterosexuals. But there were also two trials that showed no benefit among women, although at least in one of those trials, it seems to primarily be due to lack of adherence. But it does raise issues that the potential users for PrEP should be at very high risk of HIV infection and not consistently using other prevention modalities. And the cost effectiveness depends on incidence in the target groups, the cost of the medication, which currently is about $10,000 per year, and other services, risk behavior and adherence, and the cost effectiveness ends up being between $32,000 and $320,000 per quality saves, depending on these factors. So all of these data highlight a primordial relationship between HIV and STDs. There's an increased susceptibility. Individuals infected with certain STDs are 2 to 5 times more likely than uninfected individuals to acquire HIV infection. And infectiousness, HSV2, genital ulcer disease, and gonorrhea are associated with higher risk of HIV transmission to sexual partners. HIV infection worsens the course of some STDs, and incident STDs are common among people with HIV. And incident STDs also indicate potential HIV risk behavior. So these factors support what I think of as a virtuous circle, that STD and HIV prevention and treatment reduce STD and HIV acquisition and transmission. So how do we, with this growing epidemic and a plethora of interventions and constricting resources, how do we reach our prevention goals? So to answer the question, I'd like to highlight some issues about high-impact prevention. Several years ago, the concept of combination prevention was developed to embrace multiple disciplines and approaches, and it changed the way we conceptualized HIV prevention and led to many positive effects. However, I'd like to discuss why we need more, because combining interventions is not enough. All interventions are not effective, and all effective interventions are not equal. We need to prioritize. High-impact prevention calls for applying the science of implementation to choosing, mixing, and maximizing impact. And the key components are listed here. It's effectiveness and cost, feasibility of full-scale implementation, coverage of the targeted population, prioritizing our efforts, and effectively distributing resources. We ultimately need to prevent the most HIV and reduce disparities. And this framework is aligned with the national strategy and helps us choose the most impactful interventions that should be implemented in the right populations at the right scale. And I wanted to highlight some programmatic examples. One is the Enhanced Comprehensive HIV Prevention Planning Project, where we provided resources to 12 jurisdictions that had 44% of the epidemic in the United States. Also, CDC's new Health Department Prevention FOA demonstrates equitable funding distribution determined by the number of people diagnosed and living with HIV. More than $339 million are distributed annually in categories A and B. And this funding formula is based on a minimum funding level, and changes in funding distribution will be implemented over 5 years. The FOA supports innovative programs by health departments and supports 30 Category C demonstration awards for a total of $20 million per year. CDC's Health Department FOA focuses on interventions and strategies that will have the greatest impact on the epidemic while allowing flexibility. 75% of each jurisdiction's budget should be spent on 4 strategies. These are HIV testing, comprehensive HIV prevention with positives, which includes ART and STD screening and treatment, condom distribution, and structural and policy initiatives. Another example is improved HIV testing. This is demonstrated through our expanded testing initiative, in which 2.8 million tests were conducted in the first 3 years, 18,000 people newly diagnosed with HIV, 70% of whom were African American and 12% Latino. And it was estimated that $1.97 was saved for every dollar invested. So CDC had also developed a new HIV testing algorithm that incorporates its fourth generation assays. And as that gets rolled out, it offers improved diagnosis of acute infection, HIV-2, and cost efficiencies. We also have some new programs for MSM, including one that's focused on young MSM and transgender of color. 34 CBOs have received funding for that. Every CBO has to provide HIV testing with a minimum 4% positivity rate. And that's $11 million a year. And we also have another MSM testing initiative, which is going to be testing and diagnosing about 2,500 people with new diagnoses and linking them to care. So here I just wanted to show how we check on some of our resources to make sure they're equitably distributed. DHAP currently spends about $621 million on extramural funding and 11% on intramural funding. The latter includes internal HIV prevention research and program support. And we assess how our resources are spent, not only by intervention, but also by focus population. So in this graph, you'll see on the left that our funding, we provide about 28% focused on programs for women, and on the HIV incidence is estimated to be about 23% among women. In this figure on the left, you can see that about 50% of our extramural funds were used for programs benefiting African Americans, 22% whites, and 22% Hispanics and Latinos. And this distribution matches well with the epidemic on the right, but is appropriately slightly higher among the most disproportionately affected racial and ethnic groups. And then examining the budget by risk category, we can see that 34% of DHAP's extramural funds are focused on heterosexuals, 16% on IDUs, and about 41% on MSM. And this matches fairly well to the epidemic as seen on the right, except for MSM, who are underfunded, with 64% of the epidemic, but 44% of the resources. And this is a situation we hope to address with some of our new programs and in discussions with grantees. So Dr. Fenton mentioned the importance of program coordination and service integration. I'd like to discuss some of these opportunities. They include some of the things listed here: screening, partner services, and case management. There are also some obvious areas with syphilis, gonorrhea, and HIV epidemics among MSM, and the hepatitis C epidemic among MSM with HIV. We both are interested in routinizing screening and treatment, and there's a benefit to supporting CBOs to become federally qualified health centers. Other examples include social marketing campaigns like Get Yourself Tested, linking perinatal HIV and syphilis prevention, surveillance data sharing and integration and use. And we both operate under sensitive social and political environments, and so normalizing testing and prevention and treatment in and outside the healthcare setting will benefit all of us. So for future options for HIV and STD prevention, It's important that as we look ahead, we think about strengthened collaborations. For example, both areas can learn to better utilize healthcare systems, which I know has been a major topic of this conference. A substantial proportion of people with HIV and STDs have private insurance, Medicare, or Medicaid. And this presents an opportunity for moving beyond direct service provision and focusing on the public health role for monitoring and assurance. HIV care may portend the future, or at least part of the future, for STDs, as the Ryan White Care Act currently provides safety net coverage for clinical, social, and housing services for people with HIV. And the expanded use of electronic medical records and surveillance systems would allow for monitoring of quality of care and improved service provision along the continuum of care. And lastly, essential provisions for the U.S. adult and adolescent population should include HIV and STDs. So in summary, improved diagnosis and treatment of HIV and STDs are essential for prevention. Many people with HIV do not receive medical care or prevention services they need, increasing transmission risk, morbidity, and mortality. A changing healthcare system provides opportunities and challenges, and behavioral science and updating prevention programs will be critical to our success. And lastly, as Gail and I walk off together, I imagine us thinking of a quote from Wayne Gretzky, who's the greatest hockey player of all time, and he said, "A good hockey player plays where the puck is. A great hockey player plays where the puck is going to be." And so we will all need to envision and create that place together. So thank you.